Look for images of Jesus online and you'll encounter plenty showing long hair and long flowing robes. Yet everyday dress and hair in Roman Judea was very different indeed. Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favourite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not so famous moments in history from all across the globe. Jesus in flowing robes, Mary his mother in a veil, Mary Magdalene in red with loose flowing hair, even the disciples in short tunics bareheaded. All these and more are part of the standard iconography of Christianity. Yet both here and with Roman or Greco-Roman people in this period in general, many of our ideas on daily dress and styling are wrong. Today we're going to dig into what everyday dress was like in ancient Judea and beyond, busting some myths while also showing that, in many ways, people then saw fashion no differently from how we do today. And to join me on that journey is Dr. Katie Turner. Thank you for coming on the show, Katie.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
So for those unfamiliar with Katie's work, she is a historian of Second Temple Judaism and New Testament reception. She specializes in first century clothing and how it's represented, or more precisely, which I like this, why it's not represented in Christian art and drama. Because I think that's when we talked about this and ended up deciding to do the pod, like my minor is in theology, philosophy and religious studies. So I'm a historian, but like, I was the one who was always sticking his hand up and going, can we talk a bit more about Q-Source? Can we talk a bit more about how the historiography and everything else of this? And just read various of your articles and things like that. And it's always stood out to me that, like, this is a big thing, isn't it? The vision we have of this period versus the reality, often vastly different.
Yeah, we get very, very little in the history of the sort of representational tradition of the early Christian narrative. So what is written about in the New Testament is not depicted with reference to historical accuracy. And for reasons that are perfectly legitimate, they're using theology and more specifically Christology. So how is the nature of Christ understood and his purpose on earth? These things are being communicated in art quite intentionally. But they become so embedded in tradition that as we get more towards the modern period, and some scholars and some artists want to engage with history a bit more and think more about historical accuracy, they're still using the same thought processes that earlier artists were using. And so the style changes, but the underlying problems are still the same, and they're still not engaging actually with history, unless you're looking specifically at like Pontius Pilate and the Roman soldiers. And so by the end of the 19th century, Pilate and the Roman soldiers, they become this sort of mask, because we know they're historically accurate. The assumption is then everything is. So they lend a kind of patina of accuracy to the way that we think about the first century and the New Testament and what Jews in antiquity look like. It's just such a deeply embedded problem, really, that we are never actually engaging in history there.
It's like, I like to think of it as the military uniform problem, which is there are plenty of people out there who will nerd out about military uniforms. So over time, we have drifted into very accurate, or relatively accurate depictions of military uniforms of all eras. Because there's always someone that turn around and go, no, they'd never have worn armor like that. They'd never have worn armor like that. What you don't get is someone necessarily turning around and going, hang on, that mantle, that civilian part of that outfit isn't accurate. Those voices just aren't always there. And so this is why I find this topic really fascinating, because it is an opportunity to say, actually, let's step back and think about from a civilian, from an everyday life side of things, what would have been the dress? How would people approach their dress? And actually something we'll get on into a bit, which I really like that comes out in your writing, is about a recognition of aspirational dress as well, which we'll get onto a bit later. But like, people are complex, but we've always been kind of complex in the same ways. And I love that it reflects
humans are human. They just can continue to have the same sorts of motivations through various different time periods, even if the way that those motivations end up rolling out in practice is different.
So let's start with a bit of general context then. So we're sure. talking, as you say here, we're talking round about the sort of first century, and we're talking an area that is under Roman occupation, and we're in an area that is a lived area. This is an area where there are multiple clothing industries, where it's been part of the of Alexander's expanded empire before this. So this is a bit of a melting pot in terms of cultural influences at this time, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the entire Mediterranean region is a cultural melting pot, if we want to think about it in that way. There has been a lot of travel and migration and forced migration through war and conquest and enslavement and pulling people around places. So Judea and Galilee of Jesus's lifetime are not unique in that. That's the experience of so much of the Mediterranean world. So there aren't really obvious differences that we, I think, through visual representation, we think that there are going to be. Jewish people by Jesus's lifetime are living in a Greco-Roman way, and we don't have evidence really to suggest that before Alexander's conquest, there was a really specifically Jewish way. Almost certainly in the same way that Jews today, for the most part, look like their cultural location. Yes, of course, there are small groups of Jews that maintain an exclusive sort of dress style, but even that is connected to their cultural location. This is the same throughout Jewish history. There is no clothing is not part of the Jewish body. They are not, Jews are not born looking different in the things that they put on.
Yeah, so I was doing doing some work on a future episode yesterday, and that's on Austro-Hungary and particularly Galicia in that period, so Lviv and all of that kind of area. And that has a very similar thing where you get this clash of Polish culture, of you've got a large Jewish community there, you've got a large Ruthenian, Ukrainian element there. And it's very clear in a similar way that what you get is there isn't really a, for want of another word, visual distinction between those communities. There are many ways in which they're different from each other. But actually, everyone wants to dress similar because you're all part of the same city and daily life requires you to do certain things where certain outfits are just the right outfit for doing those things. And everyone wants to kind of look a bit cool, you know?
Yeah. So there might be sort of ritual objects that Jewish people have incorporated, or specifically Jewish ways of making clothes that have been part of the Jewish existence. But we have so much evidence in different time periods of the fact that Jews were not immediately identifiable as Jews. There are references from antiquity in different time periods and locations of confusion. So sometimes within Jewish texts themselves, there'll be a story of, you know, a Jewish man who accosted a woman who he thought was a Jew and he got it wrong. And then he gets in trouble. Or we can look at, you know, enforced insignia. So in the 12th century, the Fourth Lateran Council was perturbed, is a good way to put it, by their inability to distinguish Jews and Muslims just among the general population. And so they passed a law that said that Jews and, well, they use the term Saracens, which is really a sort of pejorative catch-all for different Islamic cultures and Muslim people, that they must wear something that helps wider Christendom be able to identify a Jew or a Muslim person. And the very first country to enact that is England. And they pass a law requiring Jewish men to wear a patch that is in the shape of the two tablets of the law that Moses carries down from Mount Sinai. So yeah, this comes up in many times over. We have different ways of being able to really clearly say Jewish people were not dressing Jewishly in a way that was really easy to identify by anybody else.
So let's maybe give listeners a bit of an idea of what's our sourcing on this. Now, when you're studying this, when you're pulling together detailed looks at what people might have been wearing, what they might not have been wearing, what are the areas you're drawing information from? Because it's quite a diverse range, which I find quite fascinating.
Yeah, there's actually a lot. So the first most sort of intimate source would be material remains themselves. So the actual articles of clothing, jewelry, belts and other accessories, shoes, socks, underwear that people were wearing, a lot of that has survived and has been discovered by archaeologists. So some of the largest textile deposits, so sites that have textile remains in them for the entire Greco-Roman world are in the Judean desert. So the Judean desert provides us with some of the most comprehensive raw source material for dressing in antiquity more broadly, not just dressing for Jewish populations. So that's source number one. And then we have textual sources. So we have things written by Jewish authors where they might mention dress or clothing or like a full dress appearance. So clothing, I'm really referring very specifically to textiles and shoes, hats. When I'm using the term dress, I'm thinking more holistically. So that's including your jewelry and your accessories and your hairstyle and whether you're bearded or not bearded or whether you're tattooed or not tattooed. It's the entire everything assembled on a body, everything that goes into our appearance and how we present ourselves to other people. So text can provide a lot there. It's rarely descriptive in a way that you can say, okay, this person is outlining how someone dresses or the very specifics of their appearance, but you will get details about appearance. You will get commentary on dress behavior. Roman moralists were particularly fond of criticizing non-Roman people for the way that they dressed and their dress behavior. So we get a lot of stuff about, you know, Celts and their beards and people in India and their beards. There was a lot of criticism about beards in the first century.
They also have a weird obsession, I've noticed occasionally, with color. It gets the worst of Twitter occasionally in terms of what colors you're allowed to wear as a man and what you're not.
So color was very much associated with, some colors were associated with femininity. And so if a man was wearing them, he was effeminate. I mean, the thing about text is it's the author's opinion. And so it's really important to remember when you're reading through all of this, that just because one Roman guy was like, this is completely appropriate for anyone to dress in this manner, that does not mean that that's being adhered to. And it's the same with legislation. You would often have sumptuary laws. And this is a thing that wasn't just part of antiquity, but was very much part of the medieval world, and you can find sumptuary laws in the modern world as well. So those are laws of consumption. So what sorts of things you're allowed to own or allowed to wear. Often those laws come into place because people are violating some desired norm. So if, for example, the most prestigious purple dye is worn by the emperor of Rome, and he likes to wear it because it shows off his wealth and prestige, and other people start also wearing it because the emperor is wearing it, well, now it's harder to distinguish the emperor as special because other people are also wearing the most prestigious purple dye. And so then you might get a law that comes into place that says only the emperor can wear this dye. That doesn't mean that people are following that law. It just tells you that this is something that some people want to constrain or want to restrict for certain reasons. All of these different sorts of references, so critical references about how somebody appears, or praiseworthy references, or Quintilian, who's a Roman author, he provides a sort of guidebook for oration and how a good orator should present themselves. And part of that is instructions on how to wrap and drape your toga to give a good impression. So, you know, those sorts of things, they all give good and complex and varied sense of how people are behaving. And you can then compare those to the textile remains and remains of accessories and other things that you find in the archaeological record. And then the third source is images. And here is where things get more complicated when you are thinking about Jewish dress behavior, because during the Second Temple period, so that's the time period that Jesus is living in, and often extended until the Second Revolt against Rome in 132 to 135 CE, even though technically the Second Temple period ended with the destruction of the temple in 70 CE. In that time period, Jews did not depict the human form, at least Jews living in Judea and Galilee and Samaria and that sort of region. Jews in other regions, so Jews in Egypt or Jews in Greece or Jews in Rome, might have depicted the human form, but we would not be able to now look at those images and identify them as Jews for the reasons that I've already explained. Jews are not easily identifiable. So the best that we can say is Jews living within Judea and Galilee in that sort of area are not depicting the human form. So we don't have examples of self-depiction. And self-depiction is really important for understanding when you find textile remains and you pull them out, you don't know how that was assembled on the body or what it was worn with or how someone styled their hair at the same time. So it becomes more complicated then to put it together. And as I've already said, the texts are not providing that kind of detail to us either. But thankfully, because Jews were not dressing in a really specific and uniquely Jewish way, we can see this very clearly because the textile remains excavated from Jewish sites match what we see in images painted in Egypt or in Italy, or in Greece, in statues, and in other forms of depictions of the human form. So that allows us then to expand our evidence base into non-Jewish depictions of the human form because the clothing, the jewelry, the shoes, there is commonality. And then we can also see in text, nobody is saying Jews are dressing in a different way. There aren't critical remarks being made. Although we have criticism of beards, there is no criticism of Jewish beards. So the impression is Jews probably weren't wearing beards, at least in that time period. All this is working together to give us a really good sense of what was going on.
So let's start with some of the visual basics of people. And obviously, we're working in an audio medium, unless you're watching this on video, but we will stick to our audio descriptions here, is one thing I always like to slightly blow people's minds with my Roman historian hat on is telling them that they need to forget a world where sleeves exist. Like, I think so many people just misunderstand what a basic tunic is. So for listeners, for context here, when you think of a tunic, you're probably thinking of like something with some small sleeves and it's stitched together and all of this. At its basic level, a tunic is two bits of material, normally square or rectangular, depends on the style and who it's for. But they are basically stitched together at the top with a hole created in the middle. And it's the act of almost draping that over yourself like a modern, say, poncho, and potentially strapping it with a belt round your waist that creates the impression of sleeves. It creates that sleeved model. So just listeners, hold that in your head when you're thinking about a tunic, because it's really easy to think of everything with lots of sewing involved and everything else. But so many of the outfits of this period are about how do you take large pieces or smaller pieces of material and drape them on yourself in various ways to create an effect, to create a thing that you can wear that's either visually or is either visually impressive or is useful. So that's how a tunica would be worn. But I mean, Katie, even within that, it gets complex, doesn't it? Because it's in most instances, that's not all people will have been wearing. Even if you watch TV, you're probably assuming that like everyone was just running around in tunics all the time and only senators were wearing togas over the top. Most people are generally wearing something on top of the tunic, aren't they?
They are, yeah. So the tunic that you've described is the basic garment of everybody in the Greco-Roman world. It's important to note that you can go way back into ancient Egypt and find sleeves. And during the Greco-Roman time period, Parthian Iranian dress had tight sleeves. there were slaves up in Northern Europe. So this is very much, it's not like they hadn't invented the technology for slaves or hadn't worked it out yet. This is very much a style choice, right? They're making this decision that this is how they want to wear.
Which is the whole thing we're kind of getting at here, is so much of this is about, this is stylistic. This is as much stylistic choices as it is the nature of invention.
That's right. So you do get the appearance of sleeves from belting. The more fabric you have on your body, or the wider that fabric is that has created your tunic, the drapier your sleeve might be. And that's going to change based on wealth and status. So somebody, you know, textiles are, they cost a lot of money. They take an enormous amount of effort to make. We are talking from the start of the production process. So whether you're planting the flax to make linen, or whether you are herding sheep to produce wool, from that moment until the time you are putting a garment on your body, you are looking at well over a year's worth labor involved in that, with many, many, many people through that process. So it's important to note just how labor intensive textile production is. And that remains so today, even though a lot of that has been divorced from what we see in the West. So quantity of textile differs based on social class and also based on gender. So women would wear longer tunics than men would wear. So a proper gentleman's tunic would fall just below the knee when it was belted properly. And a laborer's tunic would be shorter still, where a high-class aristocratic woman, her tunic might fall all the way to the floor, or a bit shorter mid-calf for a laboring woman. And on top of the tunic, most people had some form of mantle. And a mantle can be classed as outerwear, but really it's part of your everyday garment. So it is not like a coat. They had plenty of other coats. We could put that aside for like a secondary outerwear discussion. So there are two primary types of mantles in the Greco-Roman world. The one that most people would probably immediately associate this time period is the toga. The toga is made from a semicircle of fabric, and it is wrapped around your body over your right shoulder, under your left arm, and there are specific ways of pleating and draping, and you're supposed to, at least according to our Roman writers, you're supposed to put thought and care into exactly how you pleat and drape. The toga was made from wool. It could come in different forms. So it could be bleached white. It could be a natural. It could have a stripe on it, usually a purple or red. And this, the form of toga would be for different people in different situations. So a senatorial toga or a candidate's toga. So if you are a candidate for Senate, you're wearing a specific, this is actually the word candidate comes from the Latin for white, which is candida. So you're wearing a white toga. Togas were restricted to citizens of Rome, children who were citizens of Rome, and male adult citizens of Rome. So adult women who were citizens of Rome did not wear a toga. They had a separate garment that they wore over their tunic. That's called a stola. So the toga is the most well-known. The other mantle that you're seeing throughout the Greco-Roman Mediterranean is the hamatian, which is the Greek term, or the pallium, which is a Latin term, or the tallit, which is the Hebrew term. And it's this article of clothing that Jews today get their prayer shawls or their tallitot from. So it is a rectangle. It is also worn draped around the body. So same sort of thing over your right shoulder, under your left arm. A rectangle is going to drape differently from a semicircle. They were generally also made from wool, but they could be made from linen or sometimes even cotton or silk. They were lighter weight. They were not as heavy as the toga. And so when Romans were away from Rome, if they were in Egypt or in Judea or somewhere where they were far away from the central seat of power, they would often neglect their toga and they would wear a hamatian or pallium instead. So that is the rectangle that you would attach four tassels to the four corners of, if you're following the Jewish law for tzitzit. But we can see it fringed or with tassel weights to help it be held in place when it's draped around your body in other forms also, so outside the Jewish community. women would sometimes wear the pallium over both shoulders instead of draping and wrapping. Sometimes they could even pull it up over their head and hold it under the chin so it's acting as a veil while they're out in public. This is as like an extra display of modesty. But yeah, so those are your two primary items. Everybody has a tunic, sometimes an under tunic for warmth. And everybody has some form of outer garment, a mantle.
And I want to go back to something you mentioned a bit earlier in those excellent descriptions, which is the concept of the color white, because this is another one I think that's really important for people to say, because we take it for granted now that almost white becomes almost our default color material. Like, I have a whole bunch of plain white t-shirts that are my undershirts that I wear beneath a more colorful shirt. Like, when we say white generally, in this context, we're not talking about true white unless, as you say, it's in a very high class environment. What we're generally talking about is natural material color, isn't it? Because
that's
color
right.
is worth talking about here. And different materials are picked precisely because they can take color better than others.
Yeah. So wool is preferred in this period because it just absorbs dye much more easily than linen. And so you can get a wider variety of colors. And wool also comes on the sheep in different breeds of sheep give you different colors of wool. So there are red wools and brown wools and black wools and white wools and cream wools. And the specific wool that you have and the color of that specific wool, once dye stuff is added to it, will also impact the final color result. So white was very much a prized color, but yes, most of the time when we're talking about when we say white is a natural white. So the wool taken from the sheep and then through processing, through cleaning and sorting and combing the fibers and then often fulling, which is a process of washing and combing after a full sheet of fabric has been made, you can really even further whiten. So you don't need to be processing to get a nice natural white. The most expensive and prestigious whites would be bleached. And bleaching was a bigger process, often using urine. So that would require you to procure urine and then go through that whole bleaching process. So it's adding more time and more production onto what you're doing. And you're also going to want to be using the finest wool to begin with in order to get that real bright white. So from start to finish, it's a much more labor-intensive process, but that doesn't mean that people couldn't replicate a real nice, clean white without doing that. But yeah, so a lot of people are wearing white, and white especially is Roman moralists say this is the color that men should be wearing. Men should be in white. They shouldn't be in other colors. And we find a lot of white in the Judean desert textiles. So we know that Jewish people at this time were following this basic widespread preference for white. And women are doing that too, but we can also find tunics and mantles that are dyed many colors, yellows and reds and purples, sometimes green, sometimes pinks, oranges, lots of colors come out of the textile remains. It's really beautiful. There does seem to be a lot of yellow if you're looking at the aged textiles now, but most of the yellows that you're seeing are whites. So if you think about if you have a white t-shirt or a white undershirt and you wear it a lot over time, it will start to yellow a little bit. Well, imagine that, especially from like human sweat.
And you haven't got the benefit of a washing machine with modern detergents to
deal with. That's right. The collection of just our bodies and how it impacts our textile fibers, and then add 2,000 years of sitting in a desert to that, and you get a very yellow, once white textile. But yeah, so when we have a narrative of Jesus, he has a transfiguration. So he appears to three of his apostles, revealing his divinity to them. And in that moment when he is transfigured, he is in a bright white garment. And that's very purposeful on the part of the author of the gospel to add that detail, because bright white itself would reveal to the reader divinity because it is such a prestigious textile.
And I think, again, back to something you said at the beginning, one of the things I find fascinating about this and about the sourcing on this is the reason they would have described him that way and in that way is because precisely because that symbology was easily identifiable to everyone across the Mediterranean. Like, it's not a thing that's just going to be recognizable to Jews. It's going to be a thing that someone reading that account or hearing that account in Rome is instantly going to make that connection in their brain. So I think that almost like pan-Mediterranean approach to this is something I find endlessly fascinating with this. Like you say, there's a lot of similarities going on. And actually, maybe this is a good opportunity to talk about aspirational dress, because this is something we all do. Everyone does. And we kind of forget that actually people would have been doing it then as well. So do you want to give a bit of a description on what aspirational dress is and maybe some examples of how it might manifest in this period?
Yeah, aspirational dressing is when you attempt to dress as the elite are dressing. You want to look like the wealthiest or most powerful members of society, or maybe today you want to dress like your favorite celebrity or somebody you really admire. You are adopting their mode of appearance. So there's a lot of nail fashion at the moment that very much is part of aspirational dressing. So in antiquity, the best indicators of aspirational dressing are in dye color. So I had mentioned at the start, really prestigious purple worn by the emperor. So that was known as Tyrian purple. And that purple, which actually could be sort of in a red tone, could be sort of in a blue tone. This is a difficulty with terminology, is that we don't totally know, because color words were much more restrictive then. They didn't have as many descriptive words for colors. So what was purple? It's sort of like what was white. But Tyrian purple came from a particular mollusk. It's a sea snail. And it was so expensive that once a little bit of dye is extracted from the sea snail, that dye stuff would trade at the same, its equivalent weight in gold. Like there's no comparison for how expensive this was and therefore how prestigious it was. Obviously, a lot of people want to look like they are wearing that most prestigious color, and counterfeiting could get close to producing something like Tyrian purple by using usually indigo, but sometimes madder, depending on what your mordant was. So your mordant is usually a mineral that you are mixing with your dye stuff, and your dye stuff could be plant or animal. We can find in the archaeological record quite a lot of things that look purple, and through chemical analysis, you can determine what it was made with, and it was made with indigo. And so it's just such a lovely window into this aspirational dressing. And we know it was going on because Pliny complains about it in his text that so many people are trying to counterfeit dye colors in order to pass themselves off as wearing something more expensive than they're actually wearing. The thing is that they weren't as long lasting. So the color would fade faster. That's the biggest thing.
I love it because it's just, we think, you know, the getting a knockoff version of a handbag on eBay is a modern thing. And it's like, no.
Yeah, not at
humans,
all.
No, humans
have been counterfeiting
been
for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that's my equivalent back then is running around in knockoff Ben Sherman shirts, you know, as a teenager, you know, it's that kind of thing. And I love that. The other thing I think maybe it's also thing is how you wear your clothes can influence that as well. And we would have seen a lot of that in this period as well. You mentioned briefly like veiling, for example, earlier, and that's another area where almost how and the position in which the level to which you might decide to cover up and profess modesty is almost partly another way of kind of acting up, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. For women, veiling is a show of modesty, but because it's a show of modesty, it also provided a sort of security. And that veil could be that they are using their mantle to veil, or it could be that they have a separate item that is just a veil. Veils have been discovered in the archaeological record. They tend to be much finer, much gauzier fabrics than a mantle. They can be in more fun colors, sometimes with stripes for decoration, often with really long, beautiful tassels at either of the shorter ends of the rectangular veil. We also know that women wore hairnets. Hairnets are in the archaeological record as well. There's quite a famous little fresco image of a woman who's often identified as Sappho, the poet, although there's no reason to assume this frescoed woman is Sappho. But in that fresco, you can see that she's wearing a gold hairnet with her curls at the front. And that's the kind of thing that would be a very high class hairnet, but you could get hairnets that were colored to match your hair color. Hair was always up for women. But because of all these aspects of dressing were associated with modesty and therefore security, they could also be denied to women at the lowest end of the social ladder. So there is a good case for saying that enslaved women were denied veils or veiling or any kind of veiling practice. Though when we see enslaved women depicted in art, their hair is still up. So this is the thing that's, women always have their hair up. I think that's a really common thing that we get in New Testament, is we got a lot of Mary Magdalene, especially with loose hair. And that was not a thing. Again, it comes down to the more fabric, the more money, because the more time it takes to produce. So that could be part of it also. I think we tend to associate veiling with women at the lower end of the social spectrum, and women at the top wouldn't. And really, the way that it actually was the opposite. That becomes another place where you can have aspirational dressing.
I think that's almost like, it's almost the I. Claudius effect, I think. It's the, we had that period of sort of Victorian and beyond writers who, for them, this period of Roman history in particular, is a period of extravagance, and they want to show that the higher levels of Roman society or at the high levels of the Herodian court, like, there's this extravagance, there's this loose moral aspect to it. So you get almost that portraying this element of women with loose hair and not being veiled, which then almost inverts in the public consciousness what actually would have been the case at the time. It's like we're reading back into things that maybe are images of them, whether it's religious imagery or just standard TV or cultural imagery, are influenced by other sources.
I mean, there's certainly a reason for depicting Mary Magdalene with loose hair. Loose hair is associated with sexual immorality, and that has been the case for a very long time, including in antiquity. And once Mary Magdalene was conflated with a few women from the gospel stories that would sit in that sexually immoral place, especially the woman taken in adultery. So once that conflation happens, then it becomes a way of demonstrating that Mary Magdalene is a sexually immoral woman. She has loose flowing hair. And often you'll get in films, there'll be a conversion moment for Mary Magdalene. And after the conversion, her hair is all covered up, you know, like a nun. So it's showing that internal shift that has happened through the use of costume, costume is always used as part of narrative. So in the same way that clothing is how we express ourselves, the same sort of stuff going on. So there's nothing really wrong with that. But if you're thinking about what was happening historically, well, historically, we have no evidence that Mary Magdalene was a sexually immoral woman in any sort of way, shape, or form. And she almost certainly wore her hair up, because all women wore their hair up. I think also it becomes a way of just depicting women who are like in the crowd, like, oh, if they're really poor, then they're not going to have their hair up because maybe that's more time consuming or something. Again, that's not the case. On the lower ends of society, we're still taking care who behave in certain ways, and their morals and their values might have been slightly different than those in the aristocracy. Again, that's just pretty consistent through human history. Morals and values of aristocracy or nobility or the people at the very top of the social ladder, I mean, think about the billionaire classes today, are very different from morals and values of people at the lower ends of the socioeconomic spectrum. But this would be one that was shared. What women do with their hair is something that was shared. That hair goes up.
And as we're on hair, we should talk about men's hair as well, both on head and beard, because again, this is another one that we were talking earlier about, like Jesus with long flowing hair and all this kind of thing. And actually, building again, listeners, on everything that Katie said already, remember that actually you're not really getting a society where people are trying to necessarily stand out unless there's a clear reason to stand out. How were men generally wearing their hair at the time?
So at this time, short hair for men, Jesus absolutely would not have had long hair. I mean, Paul even says in one of his letters that long hair on a man is, I forgot the actual word that Paul uses, but like disgraceful. And if Jesus had long hair, it seems really unlikely that Paul would have been like, men should absolutely not have long hair. So Jesus would have had short hair like everybody else at the time. It might have been, whether it would have been what we think of as like a Caesar cut, unlikely. Now we're getting into the fine particulars. Yeah, I mean, it's short hair. Some Jewish men have a tradition of growing, of keeping their side locks of hair long. The Hebrew word is peot for that, and it comes from an interpretation of a verse in Torah about not trimming the corners of your face and the corners of your head. There is not really any evidence for that being a tradition among Jewish populations in antiquity. The very earliest Jewish self-depiction that we have, so you know how I said previously that Jews were not depicting themselves. By the mid-third century, there's a synagogue built in Dura Euripus, which is in modern-day Syria. And the synagogue was filled with frescoes decorating the interior, and they were all depicting different biblical narratives. So we have depictions of Moses and David and Ezra and Elijah and Samuel and all of these important male figures. None of them have peot. What they do have in those images are very short cropped beards. And that might be a point of difference from the first century. In the first century, in the Roman world, beards were not fashionable for men. They had been fashionable 2nd century BCE. By the first century BCE, they're kind of falling out of fashion in the Greek world and also in the Roman world. And it takes until Hadrian comes up to Britain, heads north, builds his wall to keep the wildlings out. And then he comes back down to Rome sporting a beard, presumably because people up in northern Britain were wearing beards because the weather is very different and colder. And so Hadrian kind of brings beards back into fashion. But before Hadrian, we have no evidence that men would have been having beards as part of their fashionable appearance. Certainly not like how we have the priesthood in Jerusalem. The priesthood in Jerusalem were the aristocracy in Jerusalem. That you were a priest because you were the highest level families in Jewish society. And we tend to get the priesthood represented in Christian art in these really stereotypically Eastern European Jewish men way, where they have long beards and they have peot, or sometimes they just have long hair that gives the impression of peot, and they're gray and wizened.
And black robes. And
black
all of this
robes.
Kind of thing.
We can come back to the fact that there's no black. But they're almost certainly the aristocracy, the priesthood, were the most Hellenized, the most Romanized. They are the ones most integrated into that broader culture, and therefore really would not have been bearded, and their hair would have been short, and they would have been dressing in fashionable dress. It's their clothing that ends up deposited in the Judean desert when many of the aristocracy fled Jerusalem during the first revolt and then the second revolt against Rome.
Is it Cave of Letters where you've got that
discovery?
Yeah, so the
Cave of Letters is Nahal Hever. That cave was used as a refuge during the first revolt and during the second revolt. By the time you get to the second revolt, you can see that the residents have fallen on harder times. Clearly the interwar period has not been super kind to them, but the things that they left behind are still high-class things. And it includes things that would have come from the temple precinct, like incense spoons that would have been part of temple process. So we know that these are the upper levels of society. Unfortunately, the people who fled into that cave and hid in that cave died in that cave, which is really awful if you pause and think about it. There were children there, so it must have been a horrible, terrifying time for them. But we then get all of what they have left behind for us because it was preserved. We also have a lot from Masada, which was a fort built on a hilltop by King Herod. So again, that was a place that the aristocracy fled to. So there are really fine textiles there, prestigious dye colors. well-made things. So we know really how they were dressing. We know what the interiors of their homes looked like because those have been excavated in Jerusalem. It's very unlikely that their domestic interiors, the clothing that they're putting on, the accessories that they're putting on are all really Greco-Roman, but the men are growing long beards. It probably would have been mentioned also by a Roman writer if that had been the case. There had been, as beards had fallen out of fashion, some men, mostly in sort of Greek society and broader Greek culture, maintained a beard as a sign of being a philosopher. So you could make a case that maybe Jesus had a short beard as a way to show to people that he considered himself a learned person who was like a teacher or a philosopher. So for some men, it would communicate who you were or who you want to be presenting yourself as. So it might be that in this, if we are depicting everybody just through historical accuracy, it might be that we have Jesus with a beard. If you look at early images of Jesus from the 3rd, 4th, 5th century, when you start to get frescoes painted of him in catacombs in Italy, sometimes he's clean shaven, sometimes he has a short beard. So that's clearly how people are thinking about him by that point. That's a question mark.
I think that the last thing I'd want to cover on the main podcast, because I think you and I could talk forever about this. I think it's absolutely fascinating. And we will do a bit more for subscribers in a bit. The last thing I do want to kind of get into the main bit, because I love this, is hats. My favorite thing, and I think it was one of your articles I read it in, is complaints about hats, particularly the is it the patassos, which is the sort of the sun hat, like almost like a bit of like a floppy modern sun hat. And I forget which author it is that's moaning that people are wearing them in the gymnasium, which I just think is so amazing.
Author of Maccabees, who just, I mean, there's a whole section where he is complaining about how the elite in Jerusalem are being very Hellenized. And part of his discourse on his complaints about Hellenization, which basically means the adoption of broader Greek culture, that's the term Hellenized. Part of his complaint is that they are wearing the patassos, which is a really wide-brimmed sun hat that was associated with the Greek god Hermes, and say it like the French, like the fashion house Hermes. And he just didn't like it. He didn't like that Jewish men were wearing this Greek sun hat. So
let's finish on that with just, because I think just to wrap it up for the main podcast is like, who would have been wearing hats in this period and who wouldn't have been wearing
hats?
Great
question. Because when we look at art and film costume, we see so much head covering. We see men, especially the priests, who are veiling. They have massive hats on. We see lots of turbans. All of the turbans that is coming from Orientalism, that is like a topic for a whole other show. No turbans. Definitely no veiling for men. That was considered effeminate and absolutely have been avoided. You can read rabbinic writing on it. You can read the fact that Paul says men should not cover their heads while in prayer. I don't think Paul is making a distinction between early Christian practice and Jewish practice, because do remember Paul's writing letters to Gentile convert communities, and there were situations in some Roman cultic practices where men would veil, they'd pull their toga up over their head while performing different ritual rites. So in all likelihood, what Paul is doing is he's making a distinction and saying, this is a border of identity for us as Jews. We do not do that. We do not do what other people do in ritual spaces. So that's an even stronger argument for no veiling. Hats were not a function of Jewish identity until the medieval period. So that comes really late. When you see Jews today wearing a yarmulke or a kippah or a skullcap, you can use any of those words. The first was Yiddish, the second was Hebrew, the third was English. That is something that came out of the medieval period in Western Christendom. That is not something that has been with Jews for all time ever. In antiquity, there's no evidence at all that there's any kind of head covering practice that is considered uniquely Jewish. Even veiling for women, veiling was widespread practice throughout the Eastern Mediterranean, especially. So even veiling does not demonstrate a Jewish woman. We do know, however, that there's so many hats that were functional hats. So in the way that the petasos is a sun hat, there are other sun hats. Hats have been found in the archaeological record. Some of them are just really fun. There's a quarry from Roman Egypt that has a ton of material remains have come out of this quarry. And a blue felt, like pillbox style hat was one of the things that came out. Another one was a felted quilted hat that comes down like earmuff style. And it's green, yellow, and red, like in stripes along that. I mean, it's amazing. There's a theory that that is an under helmet hat, so worn to protect the head, or it might not have been. We know that there were sort of cone-shaped felted hats that you can see on little statuettes of fishermen or laborers. There was a hat associated with becoming a freed person. So if you were able to free yourself from enslavement, a hat would come along with it. So there are different functional hats. There were almost certainly hats that the temple priests wore as part of their vestments in the temple. They are called for in Torah. They are described. The high priest has to have a hat with a frontlet, like some kind of plate or something at the front. The rest of the priesthood wear a hat. And the Hebrew word there is a word, if you go down to the root, it's the same that you would get for to wrap. So it's probably some kind of wrapped headgear. But they're also instructed to remove all their vestments when they leave the temple precincts. So outside the context of doing their job as temple priests, and so the hat becomes a hat associated with a job, there's no hats. What we end up depicting, my supervisor for my PhD said this years ago, and it's one of my favorite things ever. He said, it is like imagining that the Archbishop of Canterbury wears his Easter regalia to go grocery shopping at Sainsbury's. It has a specific context in a specific place, and that is where it belongs. So when we see Caiaphas and all of that getup and everything, and he's presiding over a trial for Jesus, no. That would be worn when he was doing his high priestly job in the inner court of the temple, which we don't see in Jesus films, and just there.
Well, I think that's the perfect place to leave off the main episode. So thank you so much for coming on, Katie.
You're so welcome.
Where can people find more that you've written, work, or good things that you think that they should follow up on?
So you can check out my website, katieturnerphd.com. I have links there to things that I've written, two presentations I've given, other podcasts I've been on. I've done a bunch of consulting work, so you can look at that also to see where, when people are actually engaging a historic consultant, what ends up coming out the other side, to get a very different view of the New Testament. Yeah, so my sort of full portfolio is there, katieturnerphd.com. Yeah, that's the best place.
Brilliant. Well, and listeners, we hope you've enjoyed this episode. Obviously, subscribers, hang around because you're going to get some more. If you would like advert-free versions of this podcast, you want the extra bit of geeking out that I'm about to do with Katie and we've done with many others before, then just head on over to untitled-history.com and you can become a member there and you get access to all of those things. We also apparently have merch these days, which is rather nice. I say apparently, I do own a baseball hat now, which is very nice. Don't forget as well, though, that really you can help us out by just liking, subscribing, commenting on whatever platform you're listening to this on, because that's the way that podcasts get pushed into algorithms, into getting across to others, and just spreading by word of mouth, just saying to people, oh, I heard a really good episode on this the other day, and pinging them a link on WhatsApp. Word of mouth is everything for us. And, you know, look, if you want to back Katie's campaign to make sure hats are correctly displayed in antiquity, you need to get this podcast out widely to people.
Please, so, please. I want hats. No hats, actually.
No hats.
Like functional hats, but no functional ridiculous hats. Yeah. Oh, and socks. They wore socks with sandals.
Oh, yeah. We will talk about socks in a second. Thank you very much, regular listeners, for listening. And subscribers, we're going to talk a bit more in a second about, well, socks and everything else. You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, why not head over to our dedicated supporter page?
There, for the cost of a cup of tea, you can decide which subjects we cover next, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and join a community of like-minded people. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.